Look, no one's naive about the moment we're living in, with high gas prices and the geopolitical uncertainty that's fueling them. In January, we proposed a pause to the gas tax increase. Now, it's clear we have to go farther. And that's why, working with legislative leadership, I'll be submitting a proposal to put money back in the pockets of Californians to address rising gas prices.
Governor Gavin Newsom yesterday, during a relatively short State of the State address, a rebate that would aim to ease fuel costs was the only new proposal that came out of that 18-minute speech. The average price for a gallon of gas in California is $5.57 today. That's according to AAA. And that price is the highest in the nation. We're going to talk about Newsom's plan, why California gas prices are so high right now, and what can be done, with Jamie Court, president of the nonprofit advocacy group Consumer Watchdog. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you. Well, we don't know much about Newsom's proposal beyond what he just said. He didn't provide any details. But from what you can parse, what do you think about that? Do you think it's a good idea to issue a rebate?
I think any relief that motorists can get is deserved. And we have plenty of money in the general fund. I think this is just a way of basically doing what he wanted to do by cutting the gas tax without actually cutting the gas tax, just taking from another fund. And I think it's wise. We need to deal with the high cost of gas in California. California gas prices are $1.09 more than the average cost in the U.S., and there's no good reason for it. We've been studying this problem for a long time, and unfortunately, the government really hasn't done much about it.
Well, you mentioned the gas tax. That's one reason. Mm-hmm. There's also environmental regulations that are paid for. So what exactly is the reason behind the high prices? Can you go into the details of
what? Well, I can go into what I know.
Okay.
What I know is, if you add in all the cost of California taxes that are higher than the U.S. taxes, and you add in the environmental costs of the cap and trade program and the low carbon fuel standard, you get to 54 cents a gallon. And our, as I just said, our prices as of, I got a little different numbers, as of 3/7, it was $1.09 more than the U.S. average per gallon. So there is a big gap there between $1.09 more and 54 cents because we have environmental costs and California taxes. And that has been something that has been the subject of debate by the California Energy Commission. We've been studying the problem since 2015, and the Energy Commission, the governor, and Consumer Watchdog all agree that there is this mystery, at least 40 cent per gallon surcharge, and we don't know where it's going. We know that the costs of getting our special blend of fuel in California, it's called CARB fuel, are like, you know, pennies more. Because we have a special blend and we're reliant on basically five refiners that control 96% of the market, that they can raise prices at will and there's no competition. That's mm-hmm. That's five refiners controlling 96% of the market. And we don't know, unfortunately, what they buy their crude oil costs at, how much it costs them to make the gasoline, and what they're selling it to the gas stations at. So we don't know how much money they're making in profit, but we want to know. And in fact, there's some new legislation that we're going to announce shortly with Senator Ben Allen of Santa Monica to get those all those costs out there. Yeah. So we know exactly how much oil refiners are making.
Well, could one of the reasons be that we import 70% or so of our oil because we're just not pumping it as much as other states? So we get it from Alaska, we get it from abroad, a little bit from Russia, in fact. And maybe that adds money because of added shipping costs?
Not really, because the crude that comes out of California is basically very heavy crude, and it's more energy intensive to refine. So we get more lighter crude. I think the biggest source is Ecuador, and very, very little from Russia. I don't think any, but very, very little. The crude, you got to remember, if a company's harvesting its own crude and putting it through its own refineries, they're not paying the world price of crude they're getting it from the earth, or they're getting it from fields they have elsewhere, or they're trading for it. But it's definitely not what $127 a barrel that they're paying for crude. So, I mean, the cost of refining has been, have been basically said to be the environmental costs. And the environmental costs, I just said, added, you know, with the extra taxes, 54 cents a gallon, a few pennies more for our special blend. But the deal is they can charge more because we are the only ones largely who make our blend of fuel. So they have us over a barrel. We
so
can't import it. And that's the problem.
So do you think that there's price gouging going on at that level and also maybe at the local retail level? Because when you drive around here in Los Angeles, for example, you can pass a gas station or be forced to go to a gas station if you're desperate that is charging a lot more than the average of $5.57.
Oh, yeah. There's some that are up at seven.
Yeah.
Well, I think the big problem is with the oil refiners, with these five oil refiners that control 96% of the market, because they also control prices at like 75% of the retail gas stations in Southern California. They set the price. So when they process the oil, they get it out of the refinery, and they tell these branded stations, the ones that bear their brand, how much they're going to pay for the gas. And we have found, and the state investigations have confirmed this, that those branded stations pay 30 to 40 cents more for the same gas that is being delivered to the unbranded stations like United Oil or Costco. That's why you can pay literally 30 to 40 cents less at a independent station than a branded station. But there are so few independent stations for the same gas. But then but what happens is the refiners are making money off that extra price that they're charging their branded stations. And that's why they're basically making a killing on us. But we don't know all the costs that go into this. And that's why we've got some legislation, as I mentioned, SB 1322, Ben Allen, Santa Monica is presenting, that would require the oil companies, the oil refiners, to say how much they pay for a barrel of crude, how much it costs them to make it in the gasoline, and how much they are charging the gas stations for that crude to be delivered. And when we look at those numbers, I think we're going to find that the profits are through the roof, and then we can go to them to take that profits back with an excess profits tax rather than having to go to the general fund to give it back to the consumers. That's who should be paying for this, not the taxpayers.
Okay, so quickly, in the meantime, I don't know if you have an answer to this, but where's the best place to get the cheapest gas?
At any independent station, off-brand station, a Costco, United Oil. They're still paying 30 cents less per gallon. You see many lines at these places now. It's been pronounced since the prices have gone up. But this was a phenomenon that the California Energy Commission identified as a problem. The governor identified as a problem, referred it in October 2019 to the Attorney General for investigation for possible price fixing, and we haven't heard anything about it. So it's time for Sacramento to deal with this problem again.
All right. Well, there certainly is interest on the part of the consumer these days. Jamie Court, president of the nonprofit advocacy group Consumer Watchdog. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
The list of companies pulling out of Russia gets longer by the day. Can that affect Putin and the war? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The list of American companies pulling out of Russia continues to grow. McDonald's is temporarily closing nearly 900 restaurants. Starbucks also says it'll close cafes in Russia and stop shipping their products to Russia. And over the weekend, Visa, MasterCard, American Express all said they are suspending services in Russia. Well, as the list grows, how much do American companies stand to lose? And will it add a lot more hardship to the lives of everyday Russians? Here to talk about this is Julie Cresswell, business reporter for The New York Times. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, McDonald's has been in Russia for a very long time, basically since Glasnost. What does it say they're willing to risk? Why do they say they're willing to risk all this money? And what does it say that is going to happen to, I don't know, the average Russian who maybe eats at McDonald's frequently?
Sure, absolutely. I think what McDonald's and so many other American brands were facing in Russia was two types of risk, right? There's reputational risk. By doing business in Russia, do you risk your business elsewhere? Do you risk turning customers off in Europe? Do you risk turning customers and investors off in the United States? So that was one risk I think they all had to weigh. And then there's the operational risk. I think completely, you know, the operational risk has already happened largely because of the devaluation of the ruble. You know, the investments, the billions and millions and billions of dollars that McDonald's or PepsiCo or Mondelez, which makes Oreo cookies, have in factories there, you know, has already happened. Mm-hmm. Those assets are worth far less today than they were 2 weeks ago. It will hit their financials for sure. You know, this is a country that was producing for McDonald's, you know, billions of dollars in revenues. But I think the part of that risk was going to happen already. And then there was a reputational risk that I think would have made it even worse for them.
What does it mean for the people inside Russia, though? Like, not only the consumers, but the workers, too.
Sure. Now, I think right now what these companies, like, you know, McDonald's and the franchise owner for Starbucks, what they're saying is that they are going to pay the salaries for the employees. But it's a very sort of open-ended statement. You know, I think all of us were sort of like, for how long? You know, obviously nobody knows how this is going to end or when this is going to end. Are they going to pay salaries for a week, a month, a year? What does that mean? I think that's being done, though, I think in large part to sort of to help those people, obviously to help the Russians. But I think, again, it's also a very symbolic, you know, we're not leaving them behind, if you will.
Right. And so talk about Pepsi in particular, because they have a very long relationship with Russia. They've been there, I think, since the 1970s. And so they're halting soda sales, but they also make other things. They make infant formula, for example, and dairy products, which they say they're not going to halt because that could really hurt Russians who need that, those supplies. So and they also have 20,000 employees or so working at their various plants. So talk about their calculation, what's happening regarding Pepsi.
Pepsi is an interesting company because you're exactly right. They've been on the shelves. The Pepsi soda has been on the shelves of Russia since the early 1970s. You know, they've been through sort of a lot of ups and downs, let's say politically, with, you know, US and Russian relations over that period of time. But I think what they're doing now is the calculation is, you know, we're going to take away sort of the fun products, the non-essential products, the sodas, Pepsi and 7-Up, some of those things that we make. But we're going to keep the essential items. You know, they own 20 factories across Russia that do provide milk, dairy products, baby food, baby formula, and are likely one of the largest producers in Russia for those items. And I think they understand they would have actually caused a bit of a humanitarian crisis, if you will, had they stopped producing those items. And then on top of that, yes, they do employ 20,000 people in their manufacturing plants. But outside of that, all of these companies have built up local supply chains. So there's also 40,000 farmers that produce the ingredients and the raw materials that go into those products that also would have their livelihoods go away had PepsiCo pulled, you know, shut down completely or temporarily even. So I think it's a lifeline, if you will, not only for the consumer, but for those employees and those farmers.
And what about the credit card companies? So Visa, MasterCard, American Express, they say they're suspending their services in Russia. Does that mean that Russians can no longer use those cards?
It would seem that way. I think, again, one of the questions that we've been trying to get to with a lot of these corporations is the financial transactions. And it all seems very much up in the air right now between Visa and MasterCard halting transactions, between banks, certain banks, you know, sort of being shut off from the larger financial community. I think it's really questionable about how people inside the country are going to be paying for things. And then companies like PepsiCo, let's say, or McDonald's that wants to pay the employees, how that's happening. What are the logistics? What payment systems are they using? Do they have bank accounts in Russia that they can move money to and from? But then how do they repatriate any profits that are made from these operations back to the United States? I think, you know, you're mm-hmm. seeing that, you know, the Iron Curtain come down around this country so quickly, and it's just really unclear how loose or weak that's going to be in terms of allowing for the flow of money inside the country, but then outside of the country as well.
So you talked about this as a reputational issue for companies. They don't want to damage their reputation by, at least in the short term, operating in Russia. Are they hoping that this will actually put pressure on Vladimir Putin to end this war? Is that what they're talking about? Or are they just saying that, oh, we just can't, in kind of more vague terms, support what's going on in Ukraine?
I think, you know, the pressure is sort of a little bit of maybe the bigger pressure that's happening on Putin, right? Is you have enjoyed Western culture, food, activity, internet, everything, access to, you know, apps, websites, Apple systems for 30 years, you know, since glasnost and perestroika. You know, you've been westernized. You've got a whole generation of people that have only known sort of westernized Russia, if you will. And now that's all being taken away. So I think the pressure internally on the Putin regime and the people around Putin is sort of that loss, mm-hmm. right? Is you are now being isolated. You're being cut off from the rest of the world. And again, I think I'm not a political reporter. I'm a business reporter. But it seems to me it creates more internal pressure inside the country. The loss of jobs, the loss of access to key foods, to key stores, to key goods or services that the Russian people have gotten used to for the last 20 or 30 years, I think might be part of the strategy here by these companies and by our government.
And do you think China could step in and fill the gap for some of these companies?
They could, but it seems that they are also watching all of this very carefully also, right? Is mm-hmm. how much do they, you know, they produce a lot of things, obviously, and they can, but, you know, McDonald's is McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken is Kentucky Fried Chicken. And I think Apple is Apple. So there are products that from the West, from the US in particular, that, you know, Russia and its people have gotten very used to having. Yeah. So I think the disappearance of those can't necessarily be replicated. Can clones or less expensive diapers or whatever come in? Absolutely. But other things are going to be just really hard to replicate.
Julie Cresswell, business reporter for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there are now 2 million Ukrainian refugees. For many of us watching the news unfold, we really, really want to help and perhaps donate money. But as usual, there are scammers to watch out for. And joining us now to talk about that is Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's talk about the different kind of scams out there. What are the ways people are, scamming or trying to scam?
Well, first of all, you know, to be very careful about any calls you get about charitable aid to the Ukraine folks. They are appealing to people's generosities. And so, I mean, I got a call and it's like, where are the international children, something or another? And I'm thinking, I've never heard of you. And so they are out there. The scammers watch the news. They know what's going on and they tailor it to those. So people need to be very careful. People are getting appealed. And they're on their phones, text messages, you know, oftentimes saying they're from their bank, or they're taking over people's social media accounts and then direct messaging friends. That happened to me. Someone impersonated my Instagram account and then direct messaged my friends with some sort of investment pitch. Fortunately, they knew enough to call me. Plus, they know I'm not going to ask them for money ever. But that's how they're doing it. And, you know, you click a link, and next thing you know, they've taken over one of your accounts or created a fake account pretending to be you, then friend your friends. And because it appears it's from you, they trust it. They trust to say, I need help. My car broke down, or I'm stuck in some state somewhere. Can you help me out?
So how do we know if we are getting pitched from a legitimate organization? Because I get all sorts of emails from charities, and I'm assuming that they're legit, but maybe there are sophisticated scammers out there that imitate legitimate charities in
Oh,
emails
they
and
are
other
so
correspondence.
clever. They can make it. They can spoof sites. Everything looks legit. You know, the sign-offs. They even can find real names of people at the companies, and if you search that. So here's what I tell people: trust nothing. Trust no one. If my husband sent me a text message, I'm gonna call him up. Did you send me a text message? You know, your mama, everybody, because they can get a hold of those people. You know, a dear friend of mine. Her email got compromised, and they were able to send an email that was her email because they took over her email. And so I was communicating, thinking it was my friend, but the moment they asked for money, I knew it wasn't her. I knew it was a scam, but other people don't. In fact, about four of her friends thought it was her and sent the scammers about $1,000, so about $200, 250 each of them. And so they're extremely careful. So now just trust nothing. That's my default, because oftentimes we say if it's too good to be true, it is. But if it's coming from someone you trust, the email looks legit. There's nothing that looks nefarious. You want to help your folks out. You want to help your friends and family. So now when I get emails or text messages, I just double check everything. I don't use any numbers in the text of the email. I independently go to my bank site and look on something to see if it's legitimate.
You know, there was this idea floating around the web a few days ago to rent an Airbnb that a Ukrainian person owns and not obviously not stay there, but the money would go directly to local host to that person who owns the property. So for something like that, is that something to be aware of that there might be scammers infiltrating that particular plea?
I think there absolutely will be, but the good thing about it is that if it was an established host, they had an account, they had, you know, comments from folks, and it's and you're going to the Airbnb platform, but you still need to do your due diligence because they can create an account and maybe do fake, you know, reviews. But so you just want to check everything out as best you can. And I get it. You want to send money directly to people, but you also need to be cautious that not everybody, even though it's really terrible, there may need the money right now. So some of your dollars might be better spent giving to organizations who are on the ground and can really adapt. Identify those people who are in the greatest need.
So when we want to go that route, what is the best way to find the best charity, the one who is spending the money the most directly?
Legitimate charities that you know about, the Red Cross, the Children's Fund, the UN, any of the charities related to the UN, established organizations. Charity Navigator is one of the sites that you can vet charities. Better Business Bureau has a site where you can check out the legitimacy of charities. So there is, and almost every news outlet, my outlet, Washington Post, you go to WashingtonPost.com, we had an article about who you can donate to. So check your local newspapers, because just about everybody, the Times, the Post, the LA Times, the paper in your area, everybody has been doing articles to help people who want to give. Go to those sources, because we've got reporters who vetted things, and you're not going to get scammed that way. But I cannot emphasize enough, folks, don't click on any links on anything that you receive, even if you think it's from a legitimate charity that maybe you've got a relationship with. Don't click from that email. Get out of that email. Go to that charity's website. I'm telling you, I don't know what else to tell you to protect yourself other than to be super paranoid. Don't click anything.
Even if it's from your mom, don't click.
If it's from your mama,
especially, maybe especially if it's from your mom.
That's true too.
All right, Michelle, thank you. It's always great to talk with you.
Yeah, same here.
Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Coming up, a new movie, 3 months, is about a teenager waiting to see if he has HIV.
It's so interesting because I was like, are straight people gonna understand, like, you know, time windows for testing for certain viruses, and then COVID happened.
The director of 3 months is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the new coming-of-age film, 3 months, 18-year-old Caleb is gearing up for high school graduation. He's just been dumped by his boyfriend, and he is desperate to leave his hometown of Hollywood, Florida. But then he discovers he's been exposed to HIV.
I met a guy after Dom dumped me, and we, and the condom ripped, and it turns out he has HIV. But I don't know if I have it. I don't think I have it. I might not have it, and I have to wait until the end of the summer to find out if I do.
Caleb is played by Australian pop star Troye Sivan. The film is set in the summer of 2011, and it follows the months of uncertainty as he waits for his final test results in 3 months. Joining us now is the director of 3 months, Jared Frieder. He also wrote the film. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so, so much for having me. This is awesome.
Well, it is a pleasure, and congratulations. This is your first film, I understand, right?
Yes.
And it was quite a journey. It took a lot more than 3 months to make this film, I understand, because of the pandemic.
Oh my gosh. It was like my Jewish people before me, like wandering 40 years in the desert. It sort of felt that way. I first wrote this film 9 years ago and, try to make it as a movie. Couldn't, sold it as a TV show. That didn't happen. Finally got to make it as a movie again with my dream cast. And on March 3rd, 2020, we started production. And a little something happened right after that, which is the global pandemic. Yeah. We shot 2 weeks and had to shut down for 7 months, never knowing if we would ever finish. And we did. And I'm so grateful. But yeah, it was a wild time.
Quite a journey. Okay, so why are you setting it in 2011?
That's sort of like my youth. That's when I came of age. That's when I was an adolescent. And it's a nostalgic time for me. But it was also when I went through a similar experience where a condom broke and I had to wait 3 months to find out whether or not I had HIV. And that was sort of the time span at that time where you had to wait for antibodies to develop for it to be detected by an HIV test, which is so interesting because I was like, are straight people going to understand, like, time windows for testing for certain viruses? And then COVID happened. And now it's language for everyone. So That's sort of why I said it then.
And it's still the case that you have to wait 3 months?
I think it's there are certain tests that can detect it sooner now, but it's sort of like if you're getting a COVID test, right? There's like a PCR test mm-hmm. and an antibody test, and certain tests are 95% accurate, certain are 99% accurate. And our incredible medical advisor, who was also like on the TV during the pandemic, because he's still an infectious disease doctor that was guiding COVID as he did HIV back in the 80s and 90s. He still says today for his patients, you're not out of the woods until you get that 3 month test.
Okay, well, let's play a clip of the doctor in the movie, and he's talking to Caleb about that.
We'll test you for all STDs and have your HIV baseline today. Then you can make appointments at the front desk to come back for your HIV rechecks.
No, no need to recheck. I am officially celibate until death.
Right. But today's test won't determine whether you contracted the virus from this exposure. The test looks for HIV antibodies, and they take time to develop. In the meantime, I run a support group twice a week. We'd be happy to have you.
Yeah, but like, I don't even know if I have it.
So is that what happened to you when you went in to get tested, that you were offered a support group?
No, that part is fictionalized. You know, for me, it was important to stay true to like the lessons I learned and the emotional truths that I had to experience over the course of my waiting. But so much of this is just highly fictionalized, you know, to create a compelling story. But one of the intentions I set out to do with this film was also to make those centers, you know, feel warm and welcoming to queer kids, and to show that there mm-hmm. were those resources in their communities, because not everybody knows about that. So it wasn't exactly something I went through, but it was something I felt like I should talk about.
And what about that feeling where he says, Caleb says, oh, I'm just going to be celibate till death?
Well, that is definitely how I felt at the time. And, you know, because it is so scary and it is so frightening. And, you know, there's so much shame and stigma around HIV and, you know, being a queer person, having sex in the world. And for me, this was an opportunity to start dialogues and conversations about, you know, the realities of HIV today, which are basically, you know, if you have access to medical care, yeah. it's no longer a death sentence.
Did you feel ashamed?
Oh my God, yeah. Oh, the shame yeah. is so hardwired in my brain. You know, I grew up in Florida in the public school system there. And, you know, I wish I could say that things had changed, but back then there was so little education about LGBTQ plus people or correct HIV information. And, you know, now in Florida with the Don't Say Gay bill, the state is really behind with LGBTQ equality and rights and information. And, you know, I felt so much shame because I was led to believe that if I were to have contracted HIV, it was something that I'd have done to myself.
Mm-hmm. Can you go into detail about that? Like, what did they teach you about homosexuality?
You know, it was the first thing that you taught that I was taught about HIV, especially in that world, is that it was a death sentence. And they, even if it wasn't explicit, the way that they talked about it with such shame and almost like disappointment, and it was othered, you know, it was something that happened to other people that was wrong, that was a choice that they made. And it made me, I can only speak for myself, but it made me as a kid, again, feel othered and wrong. And you're just programmed to be so afraid of something that, of course, still today presents its challenges, but is not a death sentence in the way that they made me feel like it was. And it was just the culture mm-hmm. around it, the culture that persists today. And again, like with the Don't Say Gay bill, now they're legislating that otherness is wrong and should be shamed and quieted. And again, hopefully this movie can be a chorus of voices that say, you're not wrong. You will survive. You will live a long, healthy, delicious life. You will find love and joy. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, on a brighter note, he also finds romance when he goes to that support group. So he meets another teen named Esta, who's also waiting for his results. And here's a clip of them riding Caleb's tandem bike home after one of the meetings.
You can stop here.
So this is you, huh? It's cool. You got a great lawn. Says a lot about a person. I mean, look at those really nice bushes. Perfectly trimmed, A+.
Actually, live down the street, but I'll just walk.
Do I give off like a serial killer vibe or something?
No, but my dad stays up late and I didn't want him seeing a white boy drop me off on a gay two-man bike. Might raise some questions.
Got it.
So talk a little bit about that character, Esta. He's from an immigrant family. He's on his way to engineering school and he's in the closet.
Yeah, that's the clip you played. My favorite joke in the film is the two-man bike line. And Vivek, the actor who plays it, makes me laugh every time. Esta's a character that's really special to me and close to my heart. I always say that I wrote Caleb as the kid I wished I could have been in high school, whereas Esta is the kid I was in high school. And someone who is closeted, who's struggling.
So wait, you were in the closet? You hadn't come out in high school?
Yeah, I was in the closet for most of high school, except to a special select few people. And the thing that I really connect with Esta is something called best little boy in the world syndrome, which I don't know if you know what that is, but it's basically where a gay kid will overcompensate in every arena of their life, academically, athletically, because they feel so much shame about their sexuality that they're trying to basically, you know, overcompensate for it. And that's who I was. That was the emotional core that I operated from as a kid and honestly still today. And it was important for me to portray that. And also, you know, what the, you know, Indian American experience is like for a queer person. And I worked a lot with Vivek, the actor, because, you know, a lot of the characters in this film have a different lived experience than me. They have different identity, different race. Hopefully this sort of representation on screen, which I know doesn't happen a lot, will make some kids really feel seen. And that was really my intention with this character.
So how much of this movie is a movie that is for you about helping other teenagers and not being a public service announcement?
Yeah.
You know, but being kind of a public service, I guess.
I mean, it's everything. Like, if I had this movie or movie like this growing up, I would have felt less alone, you know? And we're still fighting these battles on the front lines. You know, Texas Governor Abbott has basically criminalized being a trans kid. And we think that because we've achieved marriage equality or these amazing battles, which are amazing that we've won them or gotten to the place where we have, that the fight for LGBTQ plus rights is over, and it's not. And so if I can even add to the conversation in the smallest way to make these kids stick around and realize that that which makes them different also makes them indispensable and a worthy of celebration, if I have the opportunity to do that, I would love to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so do you think it's harder now than when you were a kid in a way? I mean, a kid in high school 10 years ago. Was it harder? Do you think it's harder for teens now, given what you just talked about the legislation, the Don't Say Gay, the thing out of Texas you mentioned? Is it going backwards now?
I think it's like three steps forward, two steps back in a lot of ways. You know, like, of course, mm-hmm. since I went to that school, I think like, they finally had a gay-straight alliance, which was something I could never have dreamt, you know, when I actually attended there. So it's not to say that we haven't taken steps forward and that in a lot of respects it isn't easier for a lot of kids, especially with the advent of social media where, you know, you can just go on your phone and be connected with other queer people across your town, across your state, across the world. But now, you know, since 2016 and beyond, they're legislating anti-gay, anti-trans, anti-LGBTQ legislation into the public school systems. And that wasn't something I had when I was a kid, and it definitely makes it harder. My heart breaks for these queer kids because what people don't understand is that when kids who are young and not fully themselves yet hear about this legislation, it's going to cause kids to take their own lives. That is what happens. That is the actual reality of this, of these bills. It will cause kids to feel worthless, and they're not going to stick around. And we desperately need them to stick around because they are so beautiful and valuable and important and strong, and they just need to get to the other side to see it. So I guess, yeah, in some ways it might be harder.
How hard was it for you to come out? I guess, I don't know when you did, but you didn't in high school.
Yeah, you know, I came out in stages. You know, I came out to my parents and three of my best friends when I was 15. And then I came out to everyone when I went to college. You know, you get the opportunity to create your own new identity and start a new life. And, you know, it's hard because you don't want to disappoint people. And you're just like shrouded in shame because, especially where I grew up, you sort of learn that this side of you is, for lack of a better word, wrong. Like, I felt so wrong for being the way that I was. Mm-hmm. Especially as a young kid, it took a while for me to find my sea legs as like a out and proud queer man. And I finally have, and it was the best decision I ever made to come out. But it is a journey, and it's a beautiful one, but not without its challenges. And hopefully that comes across in the film too, just like I had my own challenges. But, you know, now I'm gay living in LA, and for the most part, life is butterflies and rainbows. So, not to say it gets better, but, you know, it does.
And are you open about your HIV status?
Yes, I am HIV negative, which was, you know, something that I learned through the process that inspired the film. But over that course of time, you know, it's a long time to wait for results. I had to come to this place where, you know, no matter what, I knew I was going to be okay, which took a lot of relearning and deprogramming of stuff that I had learned, you know, again, in the public school system in Florida. And it really opened my eyes to the status of HIV in our current modern world. And it was a story that I really thought needed to be told because we hadn't seen it before. So I was like, wow, what a great movie. And sort of here we are, you know?
Well, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you. And congratulations.
Thank you so much, Madeline. This has been such a treat. So it was wonderful to be able to chat with you about the film.
Thank you. That's Jared Frieder, writer and director of the new movie 3 Months, which you can see now on Paramount Plus. Coming up, why songwriters are protesting Spotify. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A few songs from some of the biggest stars these days, Charlie XCX, Ariana Grande, Beyonce, of course. Well, some of the songwriters of those tracks are taking to the streets. They say they're getting little to no money for writing these hits. And they formed a new activist group called the 100 Percenters. They're holding marches and rallies in Los Angeles this month, protesting record labels and streamers like Spotify, Google, Pandora, Amazon Music. Joining us to talk about all this is August Brown. He covers music and entertainment for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so who is this group, the 100 Percenters?
So this is a group of songwriters that are standing up. A lot of people are angry at streamers like Spotify for a variety of reasons these days, but this group of professional songwriters who have, you know, written, as that clip just showed, some of the biggest pop songs of the last few years, they're surprisingly underpaid for the caliber of hits that they're working on for some very specific government and lawmaking reasons and some cultural reasons within the streaming industries. And I think have felt pretty left out of a lot of the conversations and are looking to continue a livelihood they worked hard to maintain.
Right. And so they're saying basically like Spotify and all these streamers are not paying them enough. Is that the argument?
Yeah. Artists and labels and lots of other places have had, you know, similar complaints about the low payouts of streaming, but songwriters in particular, they're kind of unique in the music industry in that their royalty rates are actually set by a government body, and they've been trying to get a raise out of that for a long time, and it's very meager compared to what other rights holders in the music industry are. And as, you know, streaming has supplanted a lot of terrestrial radio and record sales as the place where people get music, their share has dwindled to a real tiny fraction of what was already a tiny fraction. And a lot of them were taking to the streets to show that people who have written huge Grammy-winning songs struggle for things like gas to get to sessions and paying their rent in LA.
So give me an example of how it works. If you have a hit on Spotify and you're a songwriter, what can you expect? How much money?
Well, so it's a government body that sets the royalty rates for songwriting, and it's I believe it's in the around 10% or so, and that's been the rates are set every 5 years by this government body, and you know Spotify already pays out you know fractions of a penny per stream in total, and the songwriter only gets that fraction of that, and you know I talked to some people at this protest that have you know worked on, you know, Beyonce songs, who worked on Ariana Grande songs, and one of them described their royalty check as being just a few hundred dollars. You know, and that's obviously not enough to make a living in LA. And you know, that's one of the big things is you know Spotify is under a lot of criticism for a variety of reasons. And I think finally, you know, seeing someone like Joe Rogan get hundreds of millions of dollars to kind of shoot from the hip as a podcaster, but people that are writing these, you know, beloved hits are not able to survive. And I think that's the main grievance here.
But if the rates are set by this government body, and I think it's called the Copyright Royalty Board, why are they not protesting that and not instead of Spotify?
Well, in 2018, that body actually did agree to, I think, a 44% rate increase to accommodate for this reality. But a lot of the big streamers like Spotify and Amazon sued to block this rate increase from taking place. And it's been tied up in court and hasn't come into effect yet. So I think they would be glad to have that raise, but they see these same streamers are, you know, standing in the way of the scraps that they're already getting. And this is I think they've, in concert with a lot of other reasons, kind of finally had enough.
Well, do they think that Spotify and the other streamers could just go ahead and unilaterally raise these rates without waiting for this government body?
I mean, they could, but they're choosing to sue instead, which right. I think is disappointing a lot of people that have already, you know, had these rates set by the government in a way that's really not livable right now. And then to see the same companies turn around and prevent, you know, what is, you know, a lawful raise, I think really, really gets to them.
What is the proposal for the raise? How much more money would they get?
The 2018 rates was about 44% off of what they were getting before. So, you know, it's substantial, you know, it's not enough to solve the problem on its own. And there are a number of other kind of cultural issues that they were protesting too around things like getting day rates or getting expenses compensated or getting a percentage of a master recording, which is pretty rare for songwriters. But yeah, I mean, even, you know, a 44% raise, as I'm sure a lot of people in the entertainment industry would understand, is that's a significant boost for people that have worked hard to earn it.
Mm-hmm. So how does it work? Do the performers, the Beyoncés of the world, do they make money off streaming, or does nobody make money off streaming except for the streamers?
To make a real professional adult livelihood, you have to have in the, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of streams, you know, as the artist. And as the writer, you're only getting, you know, a tiny fraction of that payout, you know, like 10% at best, you know, set by the government. And then that's, you know, split between, you know, any co-writers you have, which is, you know, very common in pop songwriting. And, you know, eventually it's just people are fighting over very small fractions of what's already a small fraction. And, you know, and songwriters, you know, don't often have the visibility that big artists can have in advocating for this. And, you know, publishing is a very opaque kind of corner of the music industry that, you know, when you see big songwriters like Bob Dylan selling off their catalogs, you see these really eye-popping valuations. But for contemporary pop songwriters, you're often one of many. You often, you know, don't have that piece of a big of a piece of the pie to begin with. And the streamers that took that piece of the pie are fighting you on what's left.
Well, isn't it our fault because we don't want to pay money? We want to listen to these songs for free.
Yeah, that's a lot of culture has definitely shifted towards streaming, and you know that's good for access. That's good for, you know, people being able to, you know, hits to take off very quickly. But it is if you're in the interest of getting paid a livable wage, you know, you're not getting it from the likes of Spotify right now.
All right, so they're protesting. They'll continue to protest here in downtown LA. I think there's another march scheduled for the end of the month on the 29th. Mm-hmm. August Brown covers the music industry for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for us on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. It is, of course, free. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.